From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, what do we know and what don't we know about the status of the Foxconn plant in Mount Pleasant?
I think even before the Nikkei Asian Review and Reuters report came out, it has become clear that the project was not going to be what originally was presented, what originally was expected.
Later, environmental reporter Susan Bentz previews the relaunch of our Beats Me series.
Milwaukee writer Christina Ward traces the history of 20th century America through the foods we ate.
And Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep talks about the daunting challenge of finishing a song that was started by a songwriting legend, Bob Dylan.
So I tried to get inside of the mind of a song that was started, you know, over 50 years ago. And I was thinking about the character in the song. I was thinking about a drifter, someone who is lost at sea.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. In a large field in Racine County, a sign still indicates it's the future site of a Foxconn facility that the Taiwanese company announced to great fanfare that it would build. Initial plans called for it to be a factory that would employ as many as 13,000 people to build high-tech video screens.
But now, nearly everything about the Foxconn facility seems to be in question after reports surfaced this week that Foxconn is scaling back, refocusing, delaying, or even scrapping its Wisconsin plans altogether. Rick Rommel is covering the story for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins us on the line. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk.
You bet, Mitch. Good to talk with you.
So there were a couple of reports that surfaced this week, one that originated with Reuters, the other with the Japan-based Nikkei Asian Review. And
yes,
they seem to have one major point in common, that the Foxconn project in Mount Pleasant is not likely to be exactly the one that was touted by Foxconn, Governor Walker, President Trump more than a year ago. Is that safe to assume at this point?
Well, I think even before the Nikkei Asian Review and Reuters reports came out this week, and those were important reports for sure, even before those reports, it has become clear that the project was not going to be what originally was presented, what originally was expected.
What do we know about why these changes are happening?
Basically, and this is just coming from company statements, general company statements, so keep that in mind.
Sure.
Changing market conditions, the necessity of a company in a field like this, a technology-based field, electronics, to move rapidly, adapt to changing conditions, to be nimble, and they have to have the flexibility that they say they need in order to operate profitably. And I will say that at least so far, the officials with, say, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and other business leaders who have basically been supportive of Foxconn, they agree with that. They say the company has to be given this flexibility to react to changing market conditions.
One of the keys, though, is it sounds like this would make for a much different workforce in Mount Pleasant than we originally heard. Rather than manufacturing jobs, these would be, you know, white-collar R&D and engineering positions. So what are economic development and other business leaders in Racine County saying about that prospect?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And again, the shift, Foxconn's description of the shift in the nature of the workforce, Foxconn began talking about that almost a year ago. It's gotten renewed emphasis now with the reports out of Asia. But they originally, when Foxconn presented its planning documents to the state of Wisconsin before the deal was signed with the state, they envisioned a workforce that would be roughly two-thirds, it might have even been three-quarters, basically factory workers, assembly, production operators, I think, was the name of one job title, and technicians was the other. And in both cases, these types of jobs would require no more than a high school education. That was going to be, what, maybe 10,000 of the 13,000 people that Foxconn was going to employ.
Right. There was going to be a lot of excitement about that.
Yes. So then about not quite a year ago, one of the top Foxconn executives said, we've changed our approach and we have to think about a labor force that's much more heavily engineer-based, knowledge worker-based, so that we would probably be having about two-thirds engineers and knowledge workers, one-third assembly line type workers. A few months after that, get to last summer, end of last summer, and the percentage of engineers slash knowledge workers, now Foxconn, or at that point Foxconn was saying it could be as high as 80-90%. So a very small number of basically factory workers. And that's a lot of people kind of applauded that because of the, you know, these are really good jobs. They're going to pay very well. But just recently, Mayor Barrett came out a couple days ago and said, you know, it's too bad that that's the sort of workforce they're looking at, because there are all these people in the city of Milwaukee who don't have those kind of skills, who really need jobs. And so that seems to be becoming a topic of some discussion.
Well, and in terms of the number of potential employees, originally they were talking about 13,000, I think.
They still are.
Is there a likelihood that there are 13,000 engineering and R&D jobs out there to be had?
I think the question would be, are there 13,000 engineers out there? yeah, there could be. I forget what the numbers are that the engineering schools in the University of Wisconsin system, Marquette, MSOE, kick out a year. It's a few thousand, I believe. Don't hold me to that.
Sure, yeah.
But of course, people move. You know, if there's opportunity in your field, you can move from place to place. So, yeah, I'm sure you could find the people. They just wouldn't be people who are, say, for the most part, living in the central city of Milwaukee or central city of Racine.
Do we know how that those changes might impact the size of this? Do they still need 20 million square feet for mostly engineering and R&D workforce?
Another excellent question, Mitch. They have said nothing on that, but I just don't know. It would seem that if you're scaling back the amount of manufacturing, then you scale back the amount of physical space that you need, but that's just speculation.
What do we know about how many people Foxconn is already employing in Wisconsin?
We actually have a number. As of December 31st, it was 178.
And this is short of the number that they needed to hire for certain tax credits to kick in, right?
Correct. So the state subsidy package gives Foxconn up to $1.5 billion in tax credits for meeting certain hiring goals. Basically, they'd have to create the full 13,000 jobs to get all $1.5 billion. Each year, there's a sort of a threshold number that the company has to hit in order to qualify for credits for that year. The threshold number for 2018 was 260, so they fell 82 short of the goal. That's really kind of a, in my opinion, a relatively minor development as far as the company's ability to capture the bulk of these credits. The amount of money that Foxconn would have had potentially available to it for creating jobs in 2018 is less than 1% of the total credits that they potentially can gain. Plus, the contract has these what they call carry forward provisions, so that if they don't hit their hiring goals in one particular year, they can make up for it in subsequent years and capture the money that they didn't get the first year.
We talked about the size of the facility. There were a lot of people that were concerned about the potential environmental impact of a large-scale manufacturing plant. But if this becomes an R&D and engineering center, are those concerns somewhat assuaged, if you will?
Really good question. And, you know, the answer is we'll see. But I will say if they're not going to be making the gigantic liquid crystal display panels that they started out planning to make, they potentially could be requiring far less water than initially envisioned. The production of these display panels is really highly water intensive. And if you're not going to make them, I don't know, it kind of stands to reason, though again, this is speculation, that they would not need anywhere near as much water as had been thought.
Do we know how thirsty many of these engineers might be?
Well, it can get pretty hot in Wisconsin in the summer. So,
one more question, and that is that just briefly about this other report from Nikkei Asian Review, which was much more extreme. It says work is coming to a halt at the site. Is there any evidence for that claim?
Yeah, there's a big asterisk next to that. I believe the report says that they are suspending work at Wisconsin, as well as at the site in Guangzhou, China, where they're building, incidentally, where they're building the kind of LCD manufacturing complex that they had said they were going to build in Wisconsin. The way I read it was Nikkei Asian Review was saying, well, we're going to put this on hold for now and then come back and look at it again at some point down the road. I didn't take halt to mean permanently stop by any means.
Well, Rick Rimmel, thank you so much for helping us try to put some of this latest news in the context of the bigger picture.
You bet, Mitch. Good talking to you.
Rick Rimmel is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You'll find more Foxconn coverage at WUWM.com.
Foxconn's potential impact on the environment was a big question as the project was announced, but people have many other environmental questions about the region as well. We'll answer one of those questions on Monday's show with the relaunch of our Beats Me series. Environmental reporter Susan Bentz is with us in the studio. Hi, Susan.
Hello, Mitch.
So let's talk about Beats Me. This is our crowdsourced project for each of our beat reporters. You are our most tenured beat reporter covering the environment for quite some time. First of all, why is it so important for you to hear from listeners?
I think that all of the beat reporters feel that we have so much to cover. There's so much material that is both important and interesting. And so hearing from our listeners what they most care about, whether it's interest, concern, or a little combination thereof, it really helps us tailor our stories to what they want to hear.
What are the kinds of questions that get you most fired up when you see them come in?
Over time have received, in my beat area, have received a lot of questions about landfill recycling. And I think people are interested in better knowing what they can do to make a difference.
This is the kind of stuff that, like, this is how the environment meets my life.
Exactly. You know, what can they actually do? And we had a fun story over time. The story we told in the past was, can you actually swim in the Milwaukee River? And we all know the people who take care of the rivers want that to be a fact, but actually, this past summer, there was a short swim at the end of the Milwaukee River closest to the lake, which should be the cleanest. And so that gave us a chance to explore, you know, can we really swim our rivers?
This week, the better question might be, can you skate on the Milwaukee River?
Can you survive?
All right. So we're sort of relaunching this series, and you are the person to relaunch it. Tell us a little bit about what you're covering on Monday's show.
We are looking at CAFOs, which are, in this case, dairy farms. And CAFO essentially means that they are caring for and raising a lot of animals on a given farm. And the listener wants to know what the impacts to the water in that case are.
And where did you go to cover this story?
The question actually came from Door County, just south of which there's been a lot of concern about CAFOs. But there are, of course, CAFOs across the state. There's many more than there were 10 years ago. I visited a group in Exonia, which is in Jefferson County, not that far away. And there's a growing CAFO in that area.
Interesting reporting being out on the scene?
It is. It's great not only hearing from people, but getting out to talk to our listeners and find out what they're experiencing and what their concerns are.
So this is your first question and answer from the relaunch Beats Me series. We're going to be hearing from the other beat reporters. If people want to ask a question, whether it's to you in the environmental beat or the education or race and ethnicity or innovation, how would they do that?
They simply would go to wuwm.com/beatsme and pose that question.
They just fill out a little form and
very simple, and we look forward to hearing from lots of people.
Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Susan Bentz is WUWM's environmental reporter. You can hear her Beats Me story Monday during Morning Edition and Lake Effect.
We will take a quick break now, and then Milwaukee writer Christina Ward gives us a history of 20th century America through our food. We learn more about the influence of American advertising cookbooks when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM.
Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Have you ever wondered why such a thing as a gingered pear and chicken salad served in lime jello exists? What about baked bananas rolled in ham served with cheese sauce? Or anything at all made with Spam or even just Spam itself?
Don't knock Spam. The foods and recipes many of us grew up with were thanks to American corporations and their advertising departments. Not only were the corporations promoting the products they were selling, they were also promoting what it meant to be an American.
Christina Ward's newest book, American Advertising Cookbooks, looks at how things like Jell-O, bananas, and Spam became household staples, and it's a fascinating story. She joins me in the studio now and explains that this book came out of her first one, Preservation, the Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration.
In doing all my research about the history of food preservation, it became really, really clear that food preservation in and of itself was such a cataclysmic event in culinary history. And then when you look, start peeling that back and looking closer, the ability to keep food longer than a few days changed how we're going to eat, because then it enabled just your small farmer to have a few more days, and then he could take it to market. And then those market folks then became processors, as they would make things out of it. And then it just, the business expanded. I mean, if you think about Hellman's mayonnaise was started by Richard Hellman in, I think, 1910. And he owned a small deli in New York City. And he and his wife made their recipe mayonnaise in the back of the shop and sold it out of the shop. And because of the technology of being able to preserve things and then start marketing and the distribution, within 3-4 years, he was nationwide.
And you think, yes, we are a business-oriented culture. You know, Americans are very good about the bootstrap thing and the entrepreneur thing and making stuff to sell. Corporations somehow took over.
They did. And it, I think that there's a myth that this rise of corporations is, you know, something of a recent of memory. It's not. So even with the example of Hellman's, they started, and by the 1920s, in the span of 10 years, they were bought out by another company that eventually became General Foods. So,
although they kept the name Hellman's.
They did keep the Hellman's as a brand, and that's one of the, I think, the things that's really interesting, is that a lot of the foods that we're familiar with today that we think are just freestanding things are just brand names, and they're owned by a larger corporate entity. And that's started right in the 1910s. This is coming out of the kind of that gilded age of the corporate robber barons. And so there was almost like an American mania for building the biggest company you possibly could. And the laws at the time kind of helped that along. What we think of as like some of the anti-monopoly laws didn't really come in until after the 1920s. And since they were enacted in the 20s, they've been kind of peeled back, you know, a little bit at a time until now, where, again, we're in a position where a lot of what they call holding companies are owning a diversified portfolio of actual companies. So you've got food manufacturers that are also cigarette manufacturers and sellers. And so it's a interesting food landscape.
Well, and as you say, it started 100 years ago, really,
it
in
did,
this country.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that we have somehow maybe tried to reverse that a little bit in the last decade or so, where, you know, we're interested in going to farmers markets and buying somebody's local preserves, or we're interested in finding out who actually owns the companies that produce the food that we eat.
And I think it's the arc. I'm a fan of pure science, but I'm also cautious about applied science, because sometimes the applied sciences are applied by corporations, and that's the unintended consequences. And I think we have to remember culturally, we're not too far away from actual starvation, where people did starve, where, you know, if you didn't know where your next meal was coming from for the next few days, you were really in trouble. And so that ability to preserve food and then fortify it and inoculate it with antibacterials and vitamins and, you know, make it more than what it actually is, when it first started in the 20s and 30s and 40s, it really served a great purpose and helped people. But the unintended consequences, of course, are the increased amounts of salts and sugars that have added to the obesity crisis in the United States. So that helped trigger that kind of the consciousness about, like, what are we really eating here? And do we really want to eat this?
Did it also affect the idea of sort of corporate agriculture, where we have monocrops because we have to support the kind of processing that you're describing here?
Absolutely. That's the story of bananas. Bananas are a monocrop. They are asexual reproducers, which means, like a tuber, like when you're planting tulips, you have to put the thing in the ground to get the thing to fruit. And by doing that with one variety over time through Central America, that decimated the local kind of flora and agriculture systems. Not to mention, because something like a banana, which has really only a few natural predators and doesn't really evolve in its DNA, is very susceptible to things like a root rot or a leaf rot. And so Central America itself has been poisoned over the past 70 years by pesticides. And so again, it's unintended consequences. We want bananas. We like bananas. But now bananas are actually on the verge of extinction because the predatory viruses and blights that have been evolving to eat those bananas are winning. So right now, and again, this is kind of the interesting thing with the science of bananas, and it's happening, as you said, with a lot of other crops too, is how do we protect from vermin and with pesticides? And so that next phase is now you're seeing a lot of what they call genetically modified, where much of the wheat crop and corn crops and soy crops in the United States are actually modified that have the pesticide adjusted in the actual seed. And so the plant itself is resistant to any type of blight.
So how did we learn to love Spam, which is one of the things you mentioned?
The story of Spam is so interesting. Again, it comes out of food preservation. In 1906, there was a law finally passed called the Food and Drug Act. And it was the first time in the United States that we had any kind of national rules about what actually was food. And it actually published a book called The Formulary, and it defined every kind of food and what was in it, what it could contain. And before that, there were a lot of food scares, contaminated foods and things passed off as food that wasn't. And so the idea of a spam, which is a pork byproduct, mostly fat with a lot of salt, prior to the development in World War I, would have never passed muster with the United States because the consumer was afraid of any kind of adulterated foods. But through really good marketing, which was the idea of saying, this is for the country, this is healthy, it's fortified, it's got vitamins, it's inexpensive, and so you should eat it. You know, you're doing your part for the war efforts by giving it to your friends and family. And so it was also served as a military ration. And so post-World War II then, as many soldiers came home, they developed a taste for that salty, porky fat, which, you know, fry it up. It's kind of delicious in a terrible way. And so the marketing then changed to say, you know, reward your hardworking men with, you know, Spam. And that's really how they taught us to love that taste.
Well, and it sounds like it's both, and I hesitate to use the word collusion because maybe that's too strong a word for it, but between corporations and the government, if it's like for the war effort.
Oh, there's collusion.
Okay, so it's not too strong a word.
Oh, it is not too strong a word at all, because one of the pioneers of food advertising was Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays, who's the nephew of Sigmund Freud, who was trained in the early psychoanalytic techniques and understanding of human psychology. His first job before he went into advertising was working for the Committee for the Public Interest, which was a precursor to the CIA and was in charge of propaganda during World War I and up until the early 1930s. So there's a definite relationship between governments and advertising and corporations. Funnily enough, I mean, it comes to his partners he was working with at the CPI were the Dulles brothers, the infamous Dulles brothers, who one headed up the CIA and then one worked for John Kennedy.
And had an airport named after him.
And has an airport named after him. So again, this also, I think, tells the story. It's a smallness. And I think, you know, part of that, we forget, we think we're a big country, but we find it here in Milwaukee, kind of that joke of small Milwaukee. When you're working in the elite, the corporations, we're looking at some of the early founding families, everybody knew everybody. So it wasn't necessarily a malicious collusion, but it was a friendly collusion of like, this is the guy you went to Harvard with. This is the guy you served in the early propaganda outfit with. And they all helped each other.
Before we turned on the microphones, we were talking about how this is about way more than food. It's about culture and defining culture and what is acceptable and what isn't through the advertising, through the kind of foods that you were told to eat or encouraged to eat. And, you know, it had even involved gender norms.
Absolutely. And this is where I think that I wanted to tell this story. Because it was that one time that I could pinpoint in the kind of American history of when we really became Americans. And it was that idea of the communications, printing presses became cheap. The food became cheaper. Travel, railroads opened up the country to the expansion. Immigrants coming in. So we had all these different influences and then people trying to control those outcomes and then having the tools to do it. So when you talk about like the idea of food from our early Puritan founders, they had very distinct ideas about what food was proper. I mean, if you're looking at early Protestant food cookbooks, there's no spices for a number of reasons. And that through line, through those families and through those generations, the traditions held true. So, you know, we're still in the 1930s and 40s and covering everything in white sauce, which is, you know, not a bechamel. It's just flour and a little milk. It's not really, it's more like paste. But the idea is to keep everything packed full of calories because you needed it if you're going to work in a factory or a farm. And keep everybody eating in a very similar way because you didn't want things that would be too exciting or too outside what the norm was. And so that's where you get like the great Born in Milwaukee, the Settlement Cookbook, which was founded by earlier settler German Jews. And as that second wave of Jewish immigration came to Milwaukee, which were mostly Eastern European and Ashkenazi Jews, who had a totally different type of outlook on food and cooking. And, you know, the highborn, very elite German Jews wanted to teach the newcomers, this is how you're American. You cook like us. And that became like a real through line through a lot of the immigrant groups had different settlement houses that were usually funded by the wives of the manufacturer factory owners here in Milwaukee. And they each had a way to help teach the kids, teach everybody, again, how to be American. And being American meant being more Protestant, more conservative, and, you know, less fun, really.
No spices.
No spices.
Where do you see this kind of influence happening now? Do we have the same sort of need to look to corporations to tell us how to eat like an American?
I think we're more savvy to advertisers, but we're not immune. I think where you see a lot of it more is with cooking shows and, you know, this is just a theory because of how we, you know, ate a lot of boxed canned foods growing up for a certain period of time, is that a lot of our food marketing is aspirational. And so what you'll see a lot of is the food, the kits, I think, are really an interesting phenomenon. So when you see those pre-made food kits, or you can order online or they have delivered, it's essentially buying food in a box. The same thing it was, you know, 50 years ago. But they've kind of zhuzhed up the marketing and you see happy people, with their families and the time. And it has this really wonderful aspirational aspect to it. And I think that's where the marketing is going right now. And I think we should also be cautious of it because the negative connotations, again, are describing who gets to be an American. So you see these like beautiful, thin people making their dinners and they're all in these very upper middle class houses. And so we have to be really careful again about the messages of class and gender and, you know, how we judge people who are eating what kind of food.
Well, and those meal kits that you're talking about, the food may come in a box, but it aspires to be fresh.
Exactly. There's still some level of preservation and artificiality going on with those.
Has to be.
It has to be.
Yeah. How is it going to come to your house in a box and not be rotten?
Right. And fundamentally, it's still, you know, I find it really interesting because just like the reading the box of macaroni and cheese where it's like, you know, boil noodles, add the things, those meal kits with that idea of aspirational freshness are still like you follow just the instructions. Don't you're not actually cooking. You're just following instructions. And that is, I think, one of the consequences of this time period in advertising cooking, it kind of took away the ability to cook. There's a whole multiple generations of folks who don't really know how to cook things anymore. I'm pro bringing back some home economics education for kids.
I completely agree. And in Europe, they still do.
Oh.
And it's both genders. It's not assumed that it's just girls.
What's interesting when you say Europe, too, is the Europeans, of course, there's processed food in Europe, but there's less effect, overall effect, than here in the United States. The corporate hold on the American food systems was so pervasive throughout the entire food system, say from like the 20s through the 70s, even now, that it was able to really shape, how we eat overall, and less so in Europe. So again, they're still fighting some of the obesity crisis that come from processed foods. But not to the extent that we are here in the United States.
It's true. I mean, for example, when I was in Germany, I heard a lot from my German colleagues about how Americans have ammonia chicken and they don't want it. They won't eat it because it's processed with ammonia to probably kill whatever it's going to, you know.
Extends
and,
the life.
Yeah. And they just will not have it.
And I think, and that's where more Americans need to, and again, there's so many different influences to find that balance. If you're going to Outpost to buy pure natural chicken or to Whole Foods, you're charged a premium for that. And so in the United States, freshness is at an expense. So if you're not in a financial position to spend, you know, X amount per week on your food budgets, your choices are quite limited. And again, that's a product of the American corporations that they can pull the nutrient levels down, they can mass package things, and you can get the caloric intake up and the nutrient levels just about barely acceptable and make it cheap enough that poor people can eat it.
Right. That's, and I was going to say, there's the word cheap enough.
Right.
Because if nothing, you know, we look for bargains in this country. That's a cultural thing, is that we all want a bargain.
We do want a bargain. And I think, and that's a great disconnect. And you and I were talking earlier, I think the difference, and that's, you know, part of what an American is seeing the cost without seeing the value. And so I think we need to find more value and worry about cost a little differently.
Well, Christina Ward, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Milwaukee author Christina Ward's newest book is American Advertising Cookbooks, How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O.
Ward will be at Boswell Bookstore tonight, where she says she'll have with her a chocolate cake made from one of the recipes in the book. Fair warning, it contains sauerkraut, and it's topped with mayonnaise frosting. She swears it tastes much better than it sounds.
It would have to. Coming up next on the program, Lake Effect alum, Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep has a brand new album that contains a couple of really significant co-writes. When Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. The last time Trapper Shep played in the Lake Effect Performance Studio, it was tracks from his EP that was based on rides at Bay Beach Amusement Park in Green Bay. Shep's new album, Primetime Illusion, comes from places not as consistently joyful as an amusement park.
But that is not to say that it is a depressing album in any way. The Milwaukee singer-songwriter and Lake Effect alum has produced another character-driven literate collection of tunes produced by Wilco veteran Pat Sansone, and it features the songwriter Opportunity of a Lifetime, a song co-written with Bob Dylan. We will talk about that in a little while, but first, ahead of a concert tomorrow night at Collectivo's back room, here is Trapper Shep, accompanied by his brother Tanner Shep, with Shakedown. Steady now.
Shake down, we're going steady. Shake down, people get ready. Shake down, we're going steady now. Shake down, we're going steady. Shake down, people get ready. Shake down, we're going steady now.
Trapper Shep and Tanner Shep in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Hey, thank you so much.
We've made it back.
You're welcome.
We're having this conversation on the cusp of the new album coming out.
Yeah, yeah. And it's taken basically, you know, no time compared to the last album, which took, you know, almost, you know, 3 years to get done. We did this thing in Wauwatosa in 10 days. We mixed it in a week, and here we are.
And for people who don't know, where do you record in Wauwatosa?
I don't know if I can give away all those.
Okay.
No, I'm just
not
kidding.
The address.
it's called Wire and Vice. It's right downtown in Wauwatosa. And yeah, we did it with Patrick Sansone of Wilco.
If I understand right, the new album also kind of emerged from some rough times.
Of course. Music always does.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was at the bottom. And I was near 30, and I'd been all around the world with my songs. I'd put out albums, gotten record deals, toured with my heroes, and I had that big existential question of, what now? And surrounding all that was, I went to my doctor and I said, why am I having this pain in my back? In my leg, I had spinal decompression surgery about 5 years ago at the Mayo Clinic. Why am I having the same pain? What's happening? And I did an MRI, and he said, you're not going to like to hear this, but you've re-herniated the exact same disc that you had spinal decompression surgery on. And that led to depression. It led to anxiety. It led to all the things that people who suffer with chronic pain have. So, yeah, I was at the bottom, and it was the classic singer-songwriter thing. I wrote my way out of it.
So I was going to ask, how early in the process, in the healing process, does songwriting play the role?
Yeah, songwriting and music has always been a place for me to go to feel comfort, and I think musicians and fans of music feel the same way. I have my headphones on, you know, half the day. And yeah, it's how I got into music was having chronic back pain. I was sitting on my parents' couch in their basement, a red checkered couch, dealing with a load of pain for the first time in my life after a series of BMX bike accidents. And I was watching an extreme sports DVD, guys jumping off cliffs, you know, that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden I heard in the soundtrack, and it was Bob Dylan's Hurricane. And it was that A minor chord that would forever change the direction of my life and gave me a new sense of purpose, and shook my world.
At some level, Do you have to have the life experiences that to give you the perspective that even though, you know, you're going through this stuff that you're going through, you also simultaneously have the view from 30,000 feet that allows you to write with that kind of perspective?
Yeah, the view from 30,000 feet is exactly that first song, Shakedown. And so that song comes from a place of like you're saying, it comes from a place of experience, and it comes from I wouldn't feel that song if I have not lived the life I have lived.
Let's talk about the next song you're going to play for us, because it's kind of attracted a fair amount of attention, and
yeah,
maybe with good reason.
Before Bob Dylan went to New York City, he stopped in Madison, Wisconsin. And it was in Madison, Wisconsin that he saw Pete Seeger perform at the university, where Pete Seeger was doing a tour of universities, which is said to have really helped give rise to the folk revival. And Dylan caught that show. And from there, he went to New York City. And it was in New York City on the day he recorded his debut album. And I just recently found this out, that he wrote 2 pages of lyrics about our great state of Wisconsin. And how I realized that was in the upper right-hand corner, it says 11/20/1961. And I was reading one of those posts online, This Day in Music History, and it said, Bob Dylan steps into the studio to record his debut album, and it said 11/20/1961. I thought, that day rings a bell. So Dylan wrote these two pages about Wisconsin, didn't make the cut on the album. I don't know if John Hammond gave it the axe or what. The song got pushed aside for 57 years until his roommate, or whoever he was living with, I don't know what term was used back then for crashing on someone's couch for an extended period of time. His roommate put it up for auction for $30,000. And I saw that lyric sheet, and just something inside of me said, finish it, finish it. And so I did.
And it seems as simple as that, but it is not as simple as that when it comes to finishing a Bob Dylan song.
No. So I tried to get inside of the mind of a song that was started, you know, over 50 years ago. And I was thinking about the character in the song. I was thinking about a drifter, someone who was, you know, lost at sea, if you will. And imagining a homeland, a safe homeland, which is what I saw on the page. And I was thinking about him being on a train, and I was thinking about this sort of click, click, the ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. So I was imagining a drifter on a train. And so I came up with the feel, and then I thought, well, it needs a chorus. So then I added a chorus, on Wisconsin, calling me that way. On Wisconsin, I think I'm going to stay. Long story short, and through a series of Hail Mary passes, they get the song to his Bobness, apparently, and I get a contract, and I sign the contract, and the deal is done. And I have a co-write with Bob Dylan.
Wow.
So there you go. We could talk all night about it, but we should play the song.
Let's hear it.
Yeah, Wisconsin is a dairy state. Guess you all know it well. I was in Wauwatosa. The truth I will tell. It's a milk and cheese and cream. Yes, I've known it all my days. And I'm going to my hometown. I'm leaving right away. I'm headed to Wisconsin, 2,000 miles to go. Madison,
Milwaukee sets my heart aglow. I'm headed to that state and my heart's beating fast. And I'll jerk my banjo gently, twiddle my mustache on Wisconsin. On Wisconsin, it's calling me that way. On Wisconsin, on Wisconsin, I think I'm going to stay. Yes, there's thoughts I left there long ago. Ones are coming now, it seems. I'll tune my banjo in the hills and feast on milk and cream. And I'll stamp my foot through the grass and I'll never know or care. Yes, my home's in Wisconsin and I'm going there. On Wisconsin, on Wisconsin, it's calling me that way. On Wisconsin, on Wisconsin, I think I'm going to stay. It's you people with your city ways are driving me insane to drink. Yes, my home's in Wisconsin. It's a better place, I think. I have been to California and I've been all around, but my home's in Milwaukee and I'm gonna own this town. On Wisconsin, on Wisconsin, it's calling me that way. On Wisconsin, on Wisconsin, I think I'm going to stay. Yes, I might as well stay.
On Wisconsin, maybe a new anthem for the states. Trapper Shep, thank you.
Thank you.
And Tanner, thank you. At some strange level, do you have to kind of, maybe not have to, but do you put yourself in the mind of this guy who was making his first record when you do this?
Of course. Yeah, for me, I just tried to get inside of the song. For Dylan, he's a complete musical chameleon, right? He's just a medium for the songs. He's always said, the songs are there, I'm just dusting them off, right? So I just tried to get inside of that song and that voice. So it was completely second nature to me. I studied folk music, actually, at the university here in town. I got a certificate in rock and roll studies through Dr. Martin Jack Rosenblum. When I got that contract, it was very cool, but I thought, well, what can I do to make this all the more special? And I took it to his old office, and Dr. Martin Jack Rosenblum passed away in the last few years. I took it to his old office that used to have a jean jacket covering that little window so you couldn't peek in. And I took the contract up, put it on his door, and I signed it. And I thought in my head, my final assignment. And I just sort of thought about him and all he taught me about folk music, because I don't think without him, I would have had the ambition to finish that song.
And I imagine, given kind of the attention that the song is starting to draw, you might be in a position where people find their way both to Dylan and to you, thanks to this sort of collision of worlds.
Well, people know about Bob Dylan,
yeah.
You know. So,
well, You were going to play one more song for us, and there's kind of a story behind it. And I guess I don't want to interrupt that the flow of that story. So before we get to that point, let me just say congratulations.
Thank you.
And the new album is fantastic. And are you playing? You are playing a show coming up in Milwaukee?
Yeah, yeah, it's at the Collectivo, February 2nd.
Okay.
Yeah. So, full disclosure for your listeners, I think most of your listeners would know at this point that I worked on the Lake Effect as an intern when I went to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee for years.
We refer to you as a Lake Effect alum.
Yes, exactly. And then I graduated to a position working underneath Bruce Winter and his nighttime music program. I was sort of a music director, I guess. I graduated to a, you know, slacker position, which was terrific. And I basically had a show with Bruce every Monday where we would discuss music, and it was really great, and I got to know Bruce. And one day Bruce said, "You know, Trapper, I got an empty slot on my bowling team tonight because someone called in sick. Do you think you could fill in?" And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know how good I am at bowling." And he said, "You said you go bowling every week." And I said, "Well, yeah, but I'm not quite at the level of, you know, I'm just not up to
competitive bowler.
I'm not a competitive bowler." He said, "Well, you are tonight." So I got there. We started having a couple Miller Lights, and it's serious. The tone is very serious. Everyone's sort of, you know, it's visceral in the air. Wisconsin Bowling League.
You worried you're out of your element.
Yeah, I had to sign.
It's league play.
Yeah, I had to sign up for the USCB that night. I had to actually sign up to be in the league and the whole thing, and so I felt pretty good. I started bowling a bunch of nines, and I got my spin on and the whole thing. And I looked at Bruce and I said, "Oh man, if all my nines were X's." And he said, "You know what, Trap? That'd be a great song for you." And so we just started kind of going back and forth and finishing each other's sentences. And before I walked out of the bowling alley that night, I had the whole song finished. And if it wasn't for Bruce inviting me to bowling league that night, I wouldn't have this song. So, of course, I need to send it out to Bruce, who recently passed away, because he was such a good spirit. And, you know, I just want to send him off into the night with this song about bowling, because it just feels so right.
Trapper Shep and Tanner Shep with a song co-written by the late Bruce Winter, "If All My Nines Were X's." It's from the new album Primetime Illusion. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski, assistant producer Maddie Andre, intern Zoe Munson, and digital producer Lauren Sigfusson.
We get additional reporting from the WUWM news team. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll warm up a little bit with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
In a suit made of corduroy. If all my nines, if all my nines, if all my nines were X's. I'm one in a 10-pin alley, just another Tom, Dick, or Sally. No team I'm on will rally for as long as I can see. Well, I hear pins and glasses clinking, and I wonder what she...